Thanks, Sean. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sean.
Nice to be here. I'm not used to getting straight to it. I was getting waiting for the how it works, and it caught me by surprise. Can't think up anything wonderful to say, but I can say my sobriety date, which is always a wonderful thing. February 13th, 1995 is the day of my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and the day of my sobriety started. And I got sober in London, England, where I was living at the time, from New York City by birth, and Richmond by transplant. I've been in Richmond a little more than 4 years now, and member of the Jaywalkers group, and you've been bombarded by us out here for the last couple of months, and it's a good thing. Great bunch of people. Love them dearly. And one of the best groups I've ever come across, and I've been lucky to move around a little bit in sobriety, and I really value what I find there. I really do. What else? Had a beautiful day. It was gorgeous out. Yeah, I got up early, and little chaos in my house. My dog went missing yesterday. He found out he didn't have to abide by the invisible fence if he didn't have his collar on. First time in about 3 years. And of course, my daughters, 15 and 17, were pretty frantic about it and all. And my good neighbors took him for the night and called the animal control. So he's in the pound again tonight. We'll have to get him tomorrow. But didn't cause any big enough chaos to keep me off the golf course this morning, that's for sure. And I got a flyer written up for the girls so they could take around, and I was out, and it's just beautiful. Got invited to a place I probably wouldn't have gotten invited to if I wasn't a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not that they know I'm sober, but it's, you know, it's about the behavior that goes with being sober. And good guys, and I had a good time. Didn't play my best, but yeah, just said, man, isn't this something? Isn't this beautiful? What a day! Great day to be sober, and I haven't had a day that wasn't in the more than 10 years I've been sober. Not that every day has been wonderful, not that every day is me singing and whistling, because that's not the truth. 2 or 3 years sober, I'd wake up in absolute terror, because I didn't know where I was going to make a living the next, you know, fear of financial insecurity would grip me, but you know, this program doesn't guarantee me anything except, you know, I don't have to drink over my perceptions and my so-called terror and my big crises, because, you know, it just really doesn't matter. You know, if I put this program first, my sobriety first, and that's what I've been taught since my first day, is, you know, nothing comes before your sobriety, John, and if you put that first, you're going to be fine. And looking back, every little crisis I ever had and every big deal that ever was really wasn't, you know, really wasn't. And that's the great advantage of being sober a while. Probably the only advantage of being sober a while, other than you can say your sobriety date with confidence. But knowing that it really is true, that there are no big deals. If you got a program and you got a sponsor and you're sponsoring people and you're going to your home group and you're doing service, it all works out. So enough about today. Today's good. Yeah, real good. Got four guys came up with me in the car for a nice drive from Richmond. Yeah, that's pretty unusual. But it's good too. It shows me a lot about where they put their sobriety too. You know, lots of other things you can do on a Sunday afternoon, especially in football season. But anyway, tell you where I came from and, you know, what it was like for me, what happened and, you know, what I'm like today as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my story is one of a typical alcoholic, which is good, you know, and especially the recovery part, typical alcoholic in recovery. So I have no great, you don't have to take notes, in other words. It's all what you hear if you're in a place where sobriety is put first. Like I said, I grew up in New York City. My father was an installer repairman for New York Telephone, and I was the first of what would be five kids, four boys and a girl. We were spaced about every 2 years except for the last one, and you know, he knows he was a mistake, but you know, a good mistake. You know, it was only like 4 years, I guess. And we, you know, didn't have a lot, but, you know, they did all right. From the outside, it looked like a pretty solid family. From the inside, we didn't know any better what was going on. A lot of yelling and screaming and hitting. You know, four boys living in the same room on trundle beds, age spread of 10 years. You know, that's guaranteed problems. I'd be shocked if my father wasn't an alcoholic. But I guess I can't say he is for sure. He'd have to say that. I know it would upset him to no end if he knew I'd say he was an alcoholic. Let's put it that way. He would not take that well. He's 75 now, but, you know, none of that caused my alcoholism. You know, getting strapped across the legs to shut up. And you know, I didn't wear shorts for a lot of years. I got a combination of white legs and strap marks for a while, but that's not why I needed a drink. You know, I needed a drink way before things started getting nasty in my house. I believe now that I probably needed a drink about five. Five was when the trouble started. Because I'm a thinker. If you classify drinkers, I'm one of those thinking drinkers. You know, and for me, to drink was to shut the noise. You know, enough. You know, I didn't know that until I got sober. That's what I was doing. But I was a worrier. You know, I think that goes with being a thinker. You know, trying to predict the future, trying to control what's going on, trying to be ready for anything. Phrase I use and it fits. I was a Boy Scout for a while. I never made it past first class scout because, you know, I think I had my first drink around 13. So I drink in Boy Scouts, uniform. It just didn't mesh, you know. Altar boy went by the side too. It's where I had my first taste of alcohol, I think. Well, that's a lie. Hot, you know, toddies for the gums and stuff. Scotch on the gums and hot toddies for flu-like symptoms. So, but the first time I went and grabbed some of my own, I should say, was the altar wine. And I only really did it to wash down the unconsecrated host I was eating because I was hungry. That's what I thought. You know, I had a lot of thoughts like that. Drank wine. What about water out of the tap? Oh, yeah, I could have done that, I guess. Yeah. Not quite as interesting, but Boy Scout gone berserk. Be prepared. You know, and so I know through working through inventory and the fifth step with my sponsors, and I've had, I'm on my fourth one now, mainly because I moved, not because they were good sponsors. I know that most of my life was lived in my head, you know, especially the bad stuff. You know, I had a pretty blessed life, but if you told me that the day before I came to AA, I would have looked at you like you had, you know, three heads. Well, what do you know about it? You know, I would have said, blessed life. You got no idea. But the outward look, again, the front that I put to the world was pretty solid for a lot of years, you know. You might even envy me. I would try to get you to envy me, of course. Try to let you think I was, you know, together guy. Especially necessary for attracting women, I found. And then they would get there and mathematically the 3 months, 6 months, sometimes 9 months, the question would be, what is wrong with you? You know, what is wrong with you? You seem like such a nice guy when I met you. And that kind of question always upset me. What is wrong with you? I knew there was something wrong with me. I hated people noticing it, you know. I thought I was good at hiding it. So usually what would happen was those people would no longer be around. You know, the family knew. You had no choice there. And I would do my best to stay away from them, you know, because they knew too much, my mother especially. I would have told you I hated my mother. She drove me mad. always in my business, always embarrassing me as a teenager, pulling me off the street corners in front of my friends. You know, it's like, and my friends would join in with me. They thought she was overbearing as well. And I would have told you I hate her. I said, just leave me alone, Mom. And my father, I thought, was all right, even though he was the one administering the beatings. But my brain had twisted it that he was doing it only because my mother was nagging him to do it. You know, John, you shut those kids up. So I was able to transfer resentments totally on her. And the old man was still kind of, he's all right. A little bit crazy, but he's all right. Anyhow, you know, that's what I was about. Doing well in school, not sure why, but I was driven to. Getting jobs, always had a job of some kind to keep the cash flow going. Didn't know, you know, that's what it was about at the time, but, you know, I had a New York Daily News paper route, and I was keeping two sets of books. You know, one that I would show my parents, and one was mine, you know, and they didn't know I had an extra $20 in my pocket every week. And that stayed true. I always worked and always driven to work. And they'd say, that's great, you're motivated. And the reality was, I know why I was driven to work, you know. I wanted to have what I wanted to have when I wanted to have it. And hanging around with kids in high school, going drinking, I got naturally gravitated to a group of folks that are probably in AA meetings or belong in them. At the age of 14, and this gang of folks would do some fun things like play basketball, go to dances, but it was always about going drinking. Always. That was whatever it was we were doing. We're going drinking next weekend? No, I can't. The weekend after that, so we'd be able to get all excited about it, you know. And somehow we'd get a drinking age was 18 in New York then, so you get a fake draft card, unscrupulous bar owners, all they want to see was that piece of paper, even though there's a little pipsqueak of a 14-year-old named me would come in, and it must be, it's comedy to think, because I was still getting proofed at bars when I was 26, 27, with this Irish baby face look I had back then, and so we were drinking in bars at 15, Steak and Brew had this all-you-can-drink special. They're not around anymore. Alcoholics drove them right out of it. It sounded like a good idea, but they just didn't know what they were doing. But the problems, you know, the problems weren't so bad. You know, I knew that, you know, I'd stopped being an athlete, sort of. I definitely stopped being a Boy Scout, an altar boy. That went by the boards. The student thing wasn't going too well either. I was at a Jesuit high school, pretty demanding, and you really should have studied a lot. And I wasn't playing football, but only because they had good parties on Saturday night. I just didn't really like getting hurt. But there were cheerleaders and there were beer parties, and you got invited if you're on the team. And yeah, the focus, no doubt, smoking marijuana, drinking, partying whenever I could. And for me, I would be unable to communicate really to a girl or someone I didn't know necessarily. It wouldn't even have to be a girl if I didn't have a couple of drinks in me. You know, I just wouldn't do it, or I'd be caught. And I'd be stammering, not really a true stammer, but you know what I'm saying. So the drink for me just was magical in that way. It made me seem smooth to myself. I don't know if I was, but I felt like I was. And it seemed to work. Gave me the ease and comfort they talk about. Always. It always did. So if you're in your head thinking about worrying all the time kind of guy, it actually builds up this, I wouldn't have called it anxiety then because I wouldn't know, but that's what it was inside me. And when I had a few drinks or more than a few, I never stopped at a few, that would go away, you know. And I'd be a kind of a happy-go-lucky guy. In fact, in my blackouts, I noted early on that people would say I'd be entertaining people and telling jokes. I mean, totally out of my character. I can't even recite a joke the next day that I could remember. Like, what joke was I telling? I couldn't even imagine what joke I was telling. So, well, you were up on the table. Yeah, people were hysterical. I said, unbelievable. You know, it just made no sense to me. It didn't compute. So I said, that was okay, though. If that was the blackout, I said, that's all right. I'm making people happy. A happy-go-lucky drunk, I guess, is what I was. Till I wasn't, you know. Yeah, because it changes. And just like being able to stay up late at night and not getting much sleep and still go to work the next day, I was able to do that at 23, 24, but not so much at 35, 36. Same thing happened with my alcoholism, you know. I could party hard for a while, but yeah, I went from 10 or 12 Heinekens before a blackout to, you know, 5 or 6, 3 near the end, 2. Embarrassing. But you know, I got out of high school, didn't get to the college I really should have. My parents were still okay that I was going to this frozen Ivy League college up in Maine. Maine, man. If I had been thinking, I wouldn't have picked Maine. I wasn't thinking, you see. So cold. And when I went, we were really hurting economically, so there was no work to be had. And my folks, as I said, they had 5 kids, and I'm basically paying my way, at least half my tuition. And I needed a job, couldn't get one. Unemployment was like 20% in 1972, 73. You know, so I was turned into a scrounge, you know, picking cigarette butts up, nice juicy ones. I'd get, yeah, there's a score, you know, and scrounging, drinking, you know, hanging around with people, and it was embarrassing. But you know, any money I had went to getting high and drinking and hanging around frat parties and things like that. But here I was paying for school, and I wasn't going to class. You know, what's that about? I'm working like a dog to come up with the tuition to go to this school, and then I look out the window. I said, nah, I ain't going. It's too cold. Yeah. I wouldn't miss my sessions, you know, learning to play the 12-string guitar and smoking a little of this and playing cards all night, but, you know, class was a whole nother thing. So, my buddy from high school ended up at the same college. Totally, I knew it when I saw him the first day. We hadn't spoken all summer, and I saw him, and I go, no. And he saw me, he says, oh, no. Because we knew, you know, what we're like, and he wasn't on campus an hour before he had this big chunk of hash. And I was walking around 4 weeks into my first semester of college with a school map. It wasn't a big school, like 1,300 kids. And I'm still looking, I'm going by the map, where's my class, and making a great impression on one and all. And that's kind of how it went. After a year and a half there, I kind of got asked to leave after a drunken prank kind of thing, just stupidity. Not even worth talking about. Vandalism. You probably heard 100 stories. I don't like it. But really what happened was I figured the math out, and if I got straight A's the rest of my time there, I still wouldn't have a B average. And I knew straight A's were going to be tough because I didn't go to class. So I thought it was a good idea to stay out of school and find myself, you know. And plus I missed it. They canceled the draft, so I didn't have to go to Vietnam. So that was good. I was a good drunk that week after they canceled the draft. Because I was number 50. I was going. So being in college wasn't important. And my parents were really disappointed, of course. I would have gone to be the first Pine to ever graduate from college. And didn't happen. My sister won that race. And I just got into this thing, living back home. Conflict was immense, and as you might imagine, because I want to be what I want to do, and I'm living in my parents' house, and my mother's there, and my father's there, and my drinking has escalated to a daily basis without even me knowing it, smoking dope all the time, and that conflict ended up in me moving out 9 months, not talking to my father at all, moving in with a woman who would become my first wife. Out of convenience more than anything. It just was a thing. Asked her to marry me in a blackout. I know that because I came to and she had the ring on. She was happy about it. We had set a date. I'm saying, whoa. Seems happy about it. Seems like a good idea. Good looking. And I went, 9 months later watching this happen. It's like, it's really happening, isn't it? Try to get out of it in the most alcoholic way possible. I'll probably save that story for another day. Embarrassing would be a good word for it. But this is the alcoholic mind. Getting caught doing what I was doing, and I was doing it. The night before my wedding would have ended up in the wedding being canceled for sure. No doubt. I mean, there's no doubt. And that's the way I do life. Saying something so rational like, dear, I really don't feel this is the right way to go. I know we've spent a lot of money. I'll pay you back, whatever it was. I'll take care of it. But let's not do this. Impossible for me. The blow of conflict, me getting caught being a total skis, was okay with me. What kind of brain is that? It's a tough brain to live life with, I'll tell you. Because hating conflict, but causing it, stirring it up, always. I still do it today in a much more gentle way. But marriage, made no sense whatsoever. We grew apart. I was becoming a journalist. I fell into this beautiful job as a copy boy gopher, and I was talented naturally at it in this international news agency. So I was growing, hanging out, telling cosmopolitan stories with wonderful people who've been all around the world. And my wife is a bookkeeper for a big company and just wants a little house, and a couple of kids and a dog. And I got big ideas. We don't fit, dear. We're moving apart. The reality is I'm incapable of loving and being loved. She's put up with me for a long time already and didn't say it out loud, but showed it in all so many ways that, man, this is a mistake too. So after about 3.5 years together, we split, went our different ways. And basically the divorce was, we treated each other as the other one's dead. There was no claims, there was no connections. It was clean as a whistle. And I was happy and moved to New York City. And even though I was happy about the divorce, emotional turmoil, huge. It really was wrenching. It was a failure. My facade was shown to be for one and all to see. Just that. And I'm living in New York City, and I'm single. And this is pre-AIDS. And I'm living in Manhattan. And cash machines were invented. Not too many years before, so it's true about New York, 4 o'clock in the morning, the bars close, and then the after hours bars open, and I was on a tear for a couple of years, 3 or 4 years, and no consequences, because you're taking taxis, and lose my occasional paycheck, getting rolled, cashing your paycheck at a bar is never a good idea, but the bartender knew it was. The bar owner knew it was a good idea, so we'd spend a lot of it there. But again, the guys I admired most were drinkers that I'm working with, and they they're really smart guys, and I'm drinking as much as they do. They're doing fine, and this is the business for me. I'm good at it, obviously, and they treated me that way. I was golden boy for a lot of years, 5 or 6 years. Getting promoted and sent on more and more exciting things and being treated with respect and occasionally, doing something like crashing my car in a ditch, flipping it over, or the worst one, of course, my last big car accident in 1981, where I made a left where I should have made a right at 20 miles an hour. I just got across this narrow bridge too, so I was pretty proud of that. Except the road sign said 120, and I always make a left when I hit 120, except I'd met this woman who lived on the other side of the, I wouldn't say the tracks, but other side of town. And so I saw the sign, made a left. into the guardrail and flipped the car 7 times. No seatbelt to save my life, but cut here, very deeply, beaten up, bouncing in the car like that with no seatbelt. And came to in the morning in the intensive care unit, and the nurse was a nun and had no sympathy for me with the Irish virus and self-imposed, she thought. And don't worry, she said, you're only here because we didn't have any other beds, because I checked myself to see if I had limbs and everything. And she gave me this attitude that was, you know, you're taking up valuable bed space here, son, you know, and basically you're just a drunk. And when they discharged me, I was shocked because I couldn't lift myself off the bed. I couldn't walk. And my brothers, one on each side of me, like, discharged me. And my parents were on their way to Mexico. They had to delay their departure to deal with their eldest son being in the emergency room where I decked the on-call plastic surgeon that my mother called, insisted come in, punched him in a blackout. When he tried to inject the lidocaine in my face, my father said, you owe your surgeon an apology. Otherwise, you decked him in the emergency room. You know, blackout caveman. I don't punch anyone. You know. Deck the emergency. This guy was world-renowned plastic surgeon. What did I do when I got home and my brothers got me to the house? Yes. Been a while since I've been home. You know, I've been in a hospital at least 20-something hours. Well, yeah, there's some vodka. You know. Let's have a drink. Let's have a joint. And no Alcoholics Anonymous meeting recommended for me, even though my blood alcohol level was stupendous. I didn't get arrested. White count was what they were worried about. White count's off the charts. Okay. I'll watch that. But here I was, you know, 1981, I was 27 years old. I was still 13 years from my first AA meeting. 13 years. My brother, who's 22 years sober now, gets sober not too long after, a couple of years after that. But what happened was, you know, work, I went back to work, and I made a comeback, and they sent me to cover the space shuttle launch, and I was back, and everything was great, you know, obviously I'd overreacted, but you know, I got to watch this stuff. The summer before, I'd had a nervous breakdown, is what they call it, you know, because you get caught having it. Well, I knew. For me, it was just a full-blown panic attack, which I started having at about 25. Here I was 27. And if you don't know what they are, you're blessed. But me, the best way I can describe it is pressure building up internally to the point where I feel like I'm either going to have a heart attack or just kind of burst, like from here. So I did a lot of clutching and walking and hyperventilating. That was the kind of thing I did. Where's John at a party? I might be upstairs walking around or around the block. Or I'd pull my car off the side of the road and just walk till it passed, you know. That kind of thing. Just became normal, you know. I learned how to deal with it. And I had those panic anxiety attacks till my first week sober. Every day. Twice took me to the emergency room of hospitals. Thinking I was dying. When I talked about thinking I had a heart attack, I wasn't kidding. I thought I was dying. The old symptoms, shooting electricity up the arms. Oh, yeah, they'd get out the AMA book and, oh, Jesus, it's true, you know. And it would get worse. And the doctors would say, you know, John, they have to do the test when you tell them you think you're having a heart attack. And they'd go through the whole thing and, you know, John, there's nothing we can do for you. You know, take, you know, plenty of fluids and an aspirin, a couple of aspirin. You know, that's all we can really say to do. And I'd say to them, you know, I'd say nothing. I said, inside I'm saying, you got to be kidding. You know, I thought I was dying and there's nothing wrong with me. And today I know they probably knew exactly what was wrong with me. But why risk being decked by a drunk? Who's not going to want to hear what you got to say, which is, you know, Mr. Pine, you might be an alcoholic. you know, with these symptoms you've gotten, we did the blood count on you. I've always had some level of alcohol in me and some level of indication of liver damage. I haven't had any permanent liver damage. God knows why. Maybe I ate 3 meals a day or something. I have no idea how it worked, but here I was, 27, 28, and the psychiatrist told me, you got to have to find a new way to live, John, and because obviously I can't help you because you're not going to tell me anything, and that's what I tried to do. I developed a new way to live. And the new way I developed was I had to get rid of the girlfriend who saw me crying in this nervous breakdown. She has to go, lovely woman, but man, that's not good for me to have someone who's been there and seen me at my worst. And essentially what I did is stayed in my New York apartment for almost 7-8 months and only went to work and back, walked past the lighthouse for the blind to cheer myself up, to say, if these people can live in New York and they're blind, you know, what are you doing, John? You know, give yourself, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, you got a good job. What are you worried about? You know, what I was worried about is, you know, I'd rather be dead, really, you know, than have to go through this. It's getting too painful, you know. As long as it didn't hurt, I'd rather be dead. And that became a common theme of what my thinking was about is, you know, like, this life just sucks. I don't know how to do it. I'm getting tired of trying to do it. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just go in your sleep kind of thing? Who's going to keep showing up for my funeral? I mean, is anyone going to come? You know, when it got near the end, it was like the people who had to come. But here I was. I thought my 30s were okay because I didn't have a car crash. I kept getting promotions. I met the second wife in a bar in Santa Monica, California. My bartender buddy told me to stay away from her. He says, John, she is a total alcoholic. We got married. She was already 6 months pregnant. We got the picture. She's out like this. Very romantic Monday morning at the Rye Town Hall. The clerk and his assistant were the witnesses. My daughters just hate this part of the story. What? And here we were, two alcoholics, and we did all right. We had a lot in common, as you can imagine. We knew what we were talking about, but I was doing things like trying to get the liquor store owner to stop selling her booze. Just don't sell it, please. You know, she was the bad alcoholic. I was the functioning alcoholic, and that went on that way for a while. And she'd stay away from it while she was pregnant, but I was able to deflect a lot on her. She was a drop-down, pass-out drunk. Bang! Yeah. Embarrassing. But to just get out of the drunken log part of it, we moved around the world, moved to Cyprus and the Middle East, and here I was, fear of financial insecurity. I'd gotten my college degree and spent the money to get it. I was looking for some security in my own heart, looking for the thing that was going to help. And as soon as they gave me the diploma, summa cum laude, Fordham University, my old headmaster from high school was on the stage. He did a triple take when he saw me, not just a double thing, especially the summa cum laude part. And for about 2 seconds, I said, yeah, that's good. But then it wasn't it. You know, I got off the stage, and that wasn't it, man. That wasn't it. Shit. What is it? His wife isn't it. His baby definitely isn't it. She's scaring me to death. Beautiful, but how can I be a dad? And God, as I understand him, took me, put me in Cyprus in the Middle East to this beautiful island where I had to face my alcoholism up close. And she did too. She got into a treatment center in England, one of the best. And I was very proud of my role in getting her sober, and I continued to drink for a while. And here comes the part where it gets more fun. I'm locking the booze up in this cabinet. You have to get on a stool to get to, like, one of those stools back there. And so she doesn't drink, and I'm up and down that stool. I was afraid I was going to fall one of these days, until there's nothing left in that cabinet, of course. And must have been quite a comical thing to look at. But we got to London, and she managed to put some sobriety together, and we had two girls now, and And we start moving apart. She's trying to stay sober. She got introduced to AA in a strange way, where it's kind of hold on tight by your hands, don't drink, and it'll be all right. You know, it's the hardest way to stay sober. So she was smoking hash the minute we landed. I mean, well, not the minute. The minute we were in the hotel, she had it delivered through our connection in Cyprus, our hairdresser. We're smoking hash, and she's so-called sober, and my alcoholism, she'd been together way too long with me, you know, 6-7 years now, and what basically happens is we're about as apart as you can be and still be in the same house. I'd get to the front door, and I'd be churning ready, and I'm sure it must have been hell for her, and I think she sighed a big relief one day when, I'm not coming into that bed, woman, until I'm invited or I'm welcome or something like that. And as soon as I said it, I said, oh, that is the stupidest thing you've ever said. And I was going to the British equivalent of Sears and buying the best double air mattress they make. It still works 11 years later. The thing is, you know, I've got a hole in it. And I was sleeping on that for 10 months, including my first 6 months of sobriety. Because it got worse, you know. It didn't get better. You know, the panic and anxiety was harder for me to withstand, and the booze wasn't giving to me what it used to give to me, which was the instant sense of ease and comfort. It was my medicine. I'd been using it for years so I wouldn't have nightmares, drink just enough. But I wasn't getting relief, so the panic was back in my life, and gastroenteritis was in my life, and keeping the facade was harder, and people at work were noticing that you're drinking. No, I'm not. You know, I was rationalizing what I was drinking at work, especially the midnight to 8 a.m. shift. So, well, everybody else gets to go out to lunch and dinner and a day shift. I can bring a bottle of wine to overnight shift. Come on. You know, I was just getting sloppy, and it got so sloppy on my bottom. Blacked out in a London West End theater where I was picking up my daughters who were seeing an incredible musical of the Captain Hook, who's he, and you know what I'm talking about. And I had been just celebrating 20 years of continuous employment at a party that just wasn't good enough. You know, and I drank just a little too much, and I blacked out, and used the bathroom in this theater after apparently barging my way in and blacked out where they had to take the stall apart with tools to get me out and carry me to a taxi. And when my little girls were then 4 and 6 saying, what's wrong with daddy? This is all I was told to, by the way, on a Wednesday afternoon a couple weeks before Christmas in 94. And I came to on the couch that night in one of those, oh, gee, what happened? And I kind of knew what happened, and then I found out what happened. And then my facade of my girls are living a beautiful life in Hampstead, London, with a big backyard and a beautiful apartment and a nice car, and I'm giving them a great life. That was gone. It was their daddy was a drunk today, you know, and what's that about? And that turned out to be my bottom. No car crash, no nothing else. It was about 2.5 months before my first AA meeting. And I tried to stay sober on my own for 17 days. I did, smoking hash and not drinking. And at the end of that 17 days, my then sober wife said, Don, you're driving me crazy. You're driving the kids crazy. You're driving yourself crazy. Just go down to the store and buy a six-pack of Heineken, please. So that's what happens when this guy doesn't drink alcohol. My wife of 7-8 years at the time would rather see me drinking with all that brings than to have me be storming around the house untreated alcoholism. And you know, it got worse. I knew I couldn't stay. The gastroenteritis, the panic, the emotional turmoil, and I called the employee assistance program. I kind of got caught saying I'd go see a psychiatrist. I told her I would, and she jumped on that. Called this number. I got it. And I asked the employment assistants, can I talk to a psychiatrist? What's your problem? Well, I'm having trouble drinking and panic, anxiety, lots of stuff. well, if it's drinking related, we recommend you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, you don't understand. I know all about AA and my brother's been sober a while. My cousin's not it. I need to see a psychiatrist. She said, no. This drinking is it's AA. And I asked for her supervisor, can I speak to your supervisor, please? And she said, yeah, of course. And she'll tell you the same thing. And I broke down. Didn't want her to know it, of course, but it kind of teared up. You know, hit me in the face, and so I'll give you the number you can call in the London office, and that's what I did. She actually said, should I get you the number? I said, no, that's all right, I'll get it. Alcoholic. It took me 10 minutes to find the phone book and get it out, and I made that call and went to a meeting that night, February 13th, 1995, in London, with no intention of becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Definitely not. It was the worst day of my life, bar none. And I'd been in Somalia in with the Marines in a real hellhole place. This day, February 13th, was no doubt worse. You know, no doubt worse. Flies, smells, whatever I had there, you know, fear for my life. Going to an AA meeting was more embarrassing than passing out in a bar after two beers. It was just like, for me, it was like, believe I gotta go to a friggin' AA meeting. And I went to that meeting trying to look good and introduce myself to Glamorous Charlotte. That was her nickname. And they knew I was new, and they one guy in particular came up to me with a meeting guide and a bunch of pamphlets and said, I'm Ricky, I'm alcoholic, nice to meet you. First meeting, isn't it? I said, yeah. He said, you're a Yank, ain't you? I said, yeah, I'm a Yank. And welcome. He says, you know, you never have to hurt from alcohol again. What? And that was an important thing to say, by the way. I heard that night, it's the first drink that does the damage. And I said, what? And if you're an alcoholic, you're in the right place. And I'm sitting there going, no. You know, my head is on full volume, right? What am I going to do? How am I going to do it? When am I going to do it? Do I need life insurance? I should have got life insurance. Why did I sell those stocks? What am I going to do? How am I going to get her to rip up the divorce papers? You know, that kind of noise. Multiply it by 10. And then you might be close, right? I can't even remember. It's so long ago what kind of life I had. And I had no intention of staying. I can't remember. It was a speaker discussion meeting. I think it was a man speaker, and I was all in my head, and I left that meeting. Right before I left, Ricky said, hey, you live around here, don't you, mate? And I said, yeah. He goes, here's this meeting tomorrow night up the hill right over here. He circled it. He said, I'll meet you there. And he just left and handed me. So I'm going to this meeting. I've made an appointment somehow to meet him. He tricked me again. It's another good trick. And but driving home that night, I didn't know where I was going because I was in such a rut. I knew where all the liquor stores and bars were. I didn't know where anything else was. But I felt better than I had in at least 15 years. And it was the kind of thing I would pay a lot of money to get, that kind of feeling. I don't mean just a little bit. This was weird. And it got my attention. I went to that in second meeting, fully expecting to be let down or what have you. Communing with my wife, who was so-called sober, smoking a bong. Communing at depth for the next few nights, going to meetings, and I didn't share the meeting until that Friday, and it was the exact same kind of story I'd just done about the guy who gets tight at absolutely the wrong moment, success coming up. It was the same thing for me, 20 years sober. I said, wow. You know, they know me. They know me. I shared it. That's me, by the way. That's what just happened to me. And they couldn't shut me up ever again after that. And because I was so vocal at meetings, they would say things like, people would come up to me, nice people like Billy and London and Copenhagen, anywhere I was. John, you really need to get a sponsor. As soon as you get back to London, you got a sponsor? You need to get a sponsor. And what they were saying in the nicest way is, man, the stuff that's coming out of your mouth is so crazy that you got to get a sponsor. because, and I know what they were saying, before you say something that's going to keep you from coming back. You know, dreadfully embarrassing. Today, nothing is that embarrassing. I can share anything that I've done in my life with a sponsee or anyone. No matter how dreadfully embarrassing the rest of the world might think it'd be, if it served a purpose. But yeah, I was running around and still being Mr. Hotshot, an international journalist, my first 3 months sober, and nobody was taking bets on whether I was going to stay sober or not. They were worried. But I would go to meetings wherever I was, Paris, Copenhagen, like I was saying. People would say, "Where are you going, man? We got a big meeting." I said, "I got to go meet some friends." "Friends? What do you know, friends?" I got some friends I got to meet. "Friends. I'll see you later. You take care of the meeting. Tell me how it went." And I became a big believer in meetings. And at 6 weeks sober, I finally asked the guy to be my sponsor. I didn't even know I was going to do it. I got the pamphlet, which confused the heck out of me. I'm sorry. I just think that's the most confusing pamphlet, questions answered about sponsorship. Guy finally told me, "How do you get a sponsor?" He said, "Pray for one." And by this time, I'm praying only because it sounds like I have to. And in a locked bathroom in my house, whether anybody's home or not, I'm locking it so nobody can see me doing this, getting on my knees and praying. To pray for one, and I did. And at 6 weeks sober, I'm talking to this guy, Ricky, who I saw everywhere. And I ran down my list of sponsors, potential two sponsors. And he said, "I don't know that guy. But the other guy, he sounds like he's all right." And out of my mouth came, "Of course, if you had more sobriety under your belt, Ricky, I'd love for you to be my sponsor." So I'm insulting him and praising him at the same time. Like I know something about the value of his sobriety, right? He's 10 months sober at the way he counted it. And it's his story, not mine, but he hadn't had a drink in a while, 3.5 years. And he agreed with me that's probably not a good idea, and sat back down. But at the coffee break, 90-minute meetings over there, by the way, mostly, he said, "You know, I was thinking, and if you still feel the same way tomorrow, I'm going to talk to my sponsor and see what he thinks." And the next day, he said, "He says it's okay. What do you think?" I said, "Sounds like a good idea." And he said, "Well, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And he knew I didn't know what he was saying, even though I'm Mr. Journalist, Mr. Editor. And he says, and that's what he said, "Are you willing to put your sobriety first ahead of anything else?" And I said, "Yeah." "He said, even those two little beautiful girls of yours?" And I said, "Yeah." "And that job, that big shot career you got?" You know, this guy was a painter decorator, which is almost everybody in London who doesn't have a job, you know. And, ex-con, spent half his life in jail, hand-drawn tattoos on his arm, all the different wives he had. He got married once just to get out of jail for the day so he could drink. Lovely man. And I said, "Yeah." And he started working with me. I was his first sponsee, and he said, "If I tell you anything that you can't find in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I want you to call me on it. Because we're going to go through that book of yours." He had me read it. And then he would ask me if I'd read it. And I'd say, "Yeah." And he says, "Read it again." You know, that kind of sponsorship. And he says, "I want you to get the phone numbers of other men in Alcoholics Anonymous and start calling them. Because I'm an alcoholic and I might drink. And I want you relying on me." Come to find out, that's humility, by the way. And if you have a problem that I don't have any experience with, I'm going to send you to somebody who has that experience. And going through a divorce is what I was doing. And he said, "I've been divorced, but I've always been in jail. It's always been taken care of." He says, "I got no experience actually doing it." So he put me on to other guys. And so I want you to share what's going on in your life and how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is helping you with that when you go to meetings. So everybody knew everything was going on in my life. You know, my first year says don't change anything. $40,000 investment I had made, greed-based investment. I said it was for my daughters, it was a lie. It was greed-based. I wanted to be rich. Blew up. Money disappeared. I was 3 months sober. My wife took off her wedding ring up, and I noticed on the way to a concert, a little over 2 months. I did my fourth and fifth step at four and 5 months, and at 6 months sober, I'm moving out, and I'm moving into what I call the dump, the apartment, which is what happens when you get separated. The wife gets a nice house with the kids, and then the husband gets the dump little apartment. And that dump became an incredible place for me. Incredible. Because I wasn't in this, trying to solve this relationship, I became a full-time member of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I learned how to be a dad to these girls who would come over every other weekend, and I'd take them to meetings with me. And they'd be babysat. And I'd take them out for lunch with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people would show me how to be a parent. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the day we moved, I moved. And my wife didn't have anybody to help her because she wasn't really a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And instead of just leaving her there like I would have, my sponsor, his friend, and another friend, we moved my wife. And we laughed. They made me laugh, even though I wanted to be miserable. Showed me. John, you just don't do this. This is the mother of your children. You take her, and you move her. You know, that's not my nature. My nature is, and I won't curse. But you get the idea. You know, get out of here. Get out of my life. And you know, and I was in a hugely active group. Reminds me a lot of the Jaywalkers, except they weren't as focused. They didn't have regular monthly business meetings. Enthusiasm galore, 12-step work, huge. All kinds of people, rock stars, theater, you know, policemen, postmen, everybody, painters, decorators. And a Wednesday night doubleheader. North Road meeting. I just loved it. You know, I was going to 7-8 meetings a week, and I had commitments at meetings that weren't in my home group. I had 4 commitments a week and meetings. And I just loved being sober, you know. I just dove into it. It was so valuable to me to have a place to go with everything that was going on in my life. You know, and it just got, I just got more involved. I went to fewer meetings, but I was more involved. You know, and I was being made ready to become a single dad. I didn't even know it at the time, but my wife finally did drink because, you know, she didn't have a program smoking hash, you know, and she knew, found out I wasn't the real problem, though it would have been nice if I was for her, but I became a single dad because she couldn't stay sober, and sort of ended up in psych units and things like that, and I had to take the girls on full time, and that's the way it's been. And I wasn't ready the day I joined it. I couldn't have done it. Absolutely unequipped. The day it happened, I'm saying, oh, man, this is going to terribly blow my life, man. This is not the kind of life I want to have, being a single dad. And here they are, 17 and 15. You know, gems. They don't want me around, you know. Come on, Dad, just drop me off. Give me the money. but they know. They love Alcoholics Anonymous. They know. You know, their mom is not drinking, but not connected, you know. She tries, but for some reason she can't. And I stay out of it. You know, I don't know why some people can't connect to Alcoholics Anonymous. For us that are here, it's hard to understand. But I also know I went to that first meeting not wanting to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it was the worst day of my life. I had fallen so low. You know, when I'd done my sixth and seventh steps, there was no doubt in my mind that February 13th, 1995 was and is the best day of my life. I mean, no doubt. Because I was at a point where I really would have rather die. And if you could assure that it was painless and not messy and not embarrassing, even though I was going to be dead, I was still worried about being embarrassed, I'm sure. I would have signed up. You know, too cowardly to do it. but I was signed up. You know, here I am today, you know, 10 and a half, whatever it is, coming up to 11 years later. Not a perfect member of Alcoholics Anonymous, believe me, you know. Still reluctant to do inventory when I should with my sponsor. I'm working with my fourth sponsor. Still talking to my third sponsor, who I love. He's just too big a fan of me now, you know. He just doesn't see me for me. He just sees the miracle of AA in me. And that's cool. That is really cool. We love each other a lot. But, you know, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's all you have to be. If you're connected here, that's all you have to be. If you're just visiting or checking it out or enduring it, it's going to be pain ahead. I've never liked pain. Best life I've ever had has come through Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't have everything my ego would want me to have. But looking back on this time and those crises and the night terrors and all this other stuff that's forced me to grow and forced me to do inventories, is what it usually is. You know, the pain gets bad enough or another relationship goes down and I just don't quite understand. I got a lot of room for improvement in the way I deal with the world. And God gave me these two little girls, I know, to show me how to be a softer, gentler man. Yeah, to learn how to love women more than I would tell you that I love women, you know. Not to use women, but to love women. And my home group does that too. I mean, there are so many beautiful sisters in sobriety that you know, I know I can count on, I'd do anything for. It's just amazing to me. My brother and I are close. He's 22 years sober. Anything goes wrong, there's no doubt. The other one's there for us, no doubt. Connection, you know, and that's what I am. Today, there's so many people in my life that I love, I don't even think of them all the time. And that, to me, blows my mind. Because, you know, the week before I come to AA, I really was thinking about who's coming to my funeral. Who's left, you know. And today, if I, you know, the Christmas card list, or the list of email or the phone calls, it'd be in the hundreds, 300 people that I can tell them that I love. And my mother, who I had to tell her first so she could start saying it to me. You know, when I made amends to her. All that time, she just, you know, she was worried about me being me. You know, me being a drunk. And me being a smoker, me being a self-destructive man. You know. Because she saw the good in me, you know. She didn't understand, right? But today, you know, I tell my mother I love her, man. It's starting to come natural for her. My father, not there yet, but, you know. My brothers, my sister, you know, we're making progress. And, you know, the Five Pines, four boys don't drink today. One doesn't even go to AA, and we can't figure out how he does it. Longer than me, but we may have broken the chain that goes back hundreds of years, as we know that's the case. Insanity goes through my family, alcoholic insanity, hundreds of years. And today it's been arrested. Still goes on in here sometimes, but I don't have to tell you all about it. Just my sponsor. With that, I'll pass. Thank you.